The Tom Woods Show, episode 1888.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. I've got something really on fire for you today, today's episode. And I need to set that episode up for you a little bit. And I'll do that in just a minute. But I want to make sure that all you guys out there, a lot of whom are interested in crypto, are aware of what my friend John Bush is doing. Because a lot of people make mistakes or, oh, gee, I lost $1 million worth of crypto because I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, come on now, right? No Tom Woods Show listener should be having problems like that. You want to get started with crypto. You want to learn how to purchase, securely hold, and one hopes multiply your crypto. Well, John has a course called Demystifying Crypto, How to Buy, Hold, and Multiply Your Cryptocurrency. And I strongly recommend you do it. I've sometimes said that one of the problems with crypto is that it's not that user-friendly. Like your grandmother would not instinctively know how to do it. And I think a lot of people feel that way. John is going to demystify it for you, and he's going to make it easy for you to do. And not to mention, they're offering a bonus section on internet privacy. So if you're tired of big tech snooping around your digital life, then this workshop's going to teach you browsing habits to hide your digital footprint and how to send and receive encrypted messages that even the state can't read. So this is not to be missed. This isn't some little random promo Woods is doing. I strongly urge you to do this. And you're going to love John Bush. He's been around forever. He's been around since he was like 12, it seems like, when I met him. He looked like he was like 12. Now he looks like he's 15. I don't know why. The guy doesn't age somehow. But you're going to really, really benefit from this. So how do you sign up for this workshop? Go to cryptoandprivacy.com. Cryptoandprivacy.com. Do not miss this thing. You're going to love it. Now for today, I'm sharing with you, if the comments on the original version are to be believed, something that is absolutely on fire. Okay, this is an interview I did just several days ago on The Naturalist Capitalist, hosted by Reed Coverdale. Now, the two things you need to know in order to make sense of this, and I really think you're going to love it. Reed really directed me through a lot of different topics, so we had an interesting conversation. There's some COVID in here, but it's not just that by any means. But believe me, we hit a lot of different topics. Names are named, let's put it that way. But there are two things you need to know. Number one is, I had LASIK surgery last week. If you're on my email list, either one of my email lists, you would have probably seen me complaining about certain aspects of it. I'm really thrilled with how it came out. But the long and the short of it is this. I was supposed to be interviewed by Reed that very night, and I didn't realize that, you know, the first day that you have it, you're supposed to have sunglasses on indoors and outdoors. So I had sunglasses on while I'm doing the interview with him. And I will probably be making reference to it here and there in the interview. And at one point, I actually have to have eye drops put in my eyes. I mean, it was just it was a nut house, but we decided to go ahead with it anyway. So that's one thing. But the much more important thing for you to know about has to do with the Libertarian Party of Nevada, which I make several references to in this interview. And they are quite disparaging references, as you will hear. Well, what you need to know is that just in the interim, just between that interview several days ago and this past weekend, there was a clean sweep. Normal people came in and swept away really the most vile group of people associated with the Libertarian Party ever. I mean, these people were somehow trying to run a libertarian state chapter while despising libertarianism. I don't think that could be done in the long run, and it turns out it couldn't. A bunch of good, decent people, knowledgeable people about libertarianism came in and swept them all away in a clean sweep. It's an amazing thing, and I'm going to be talking to the new chair of the Libertarian Party of Nevada this week on the Tom Woods Show. So I want you to know that the disparaging references I make to them, all those references are to a previous version of the Libertarian Party of Nevada, not what that party is now and will be in the future. So I just want you to know that as you listen. Now go ahead and enjoy this. I think you will. Here we go.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for watching The Naturalist Capitalist. I am your host, Reed Coverdale, and I am very excited to have on the show today an accomplished author, the host of the Tom Woods Show, Tom Woods himself. How are you doing, Tom?
I'm doing okay, Reed. Do you want to explain, or do you want me to explain why I look like this?
Well, yeah, I'm doing it in solidarity with you, but why don't you explain to everyone what's going on?
Well, my Facebook friends and my Twitter followers will know what's going on, but I had LASIK surgery done today, and for the first 24 hours, you have to wear sunglasses. And you also, I didn't realize all the details till I got there. So they have this form you have to fill out, signing, indicating that you consent to everything. And it's, oh, okay, well, there are a few things, like you can't skydive for a couple of weeks. I said, no, I can live with that. No eye makeup for a week. Okay, two for two, no problem. But then it's things like, now you are going to experience burning and stinging. And for the first day, you need eye drops put in your eyes every 15 minutes. And then for the next month, you need it four times a day. And for the first week, you need two other kinds of eye drops, also four times a day. I don't know if I would have done it if I'd known all this was, my vision was good enough, let's say, beforehand. But anyway, so I am actually halfway through this, going to have to go off camera and get eye drops put in my eyes and come back. So you guys you'll have to talk to the audience or, I don't know, have a drink. I don't know.
Yeah, no, this is completely typical for my show, all these weird interruptions. So it's all good. Yeah, it was funny. I actually saw your post on Twitter before I read the email that your scheduler sent me. And I was like, this is going to be awkward. I'm not sure how we're going to work this out. But you said something along the lines of maybe he'll find it entertaining enough that he'll still want to do it or something like that. I'm afraid it was funny.
Because you'd be the only interviewer who's ever had this experience with me. So
that's right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I didn't want to turn it down. No way. It's a once in a lifetime opportunity. But yeah, man, I'm a pretty big fan of yours. I've only known about you probably for about 4 years. I was a big Rand Paul supporter back in 2016, and that's when I first found out about you. But I didn't really start listening to you until this past year, and it was a good time to start listening to you because I'd say you were the voice in opposition to the COVID hysteria, whether it was the mandates they were putting on us, the information they were putting out about how it was being transmitted. What was that like? I mean, you've got a lot of pushback from pretty much everybody, right?
Well, I suppose so. But within the libertarian world, most people were fairly on board. I mean, just today, when I was signing my name on these LASIK documents, they're still doing these clean, sanitized pens and then use dirty pens. Like the virus is spreading from pens. You know, it's been 13 months. Even the CDC says all this deep cleaning nonsense, you don't even need to do it. Even they say it now. I mean, normal people have been saying it for a while. And there's a professor at the Harvard School of Public Health who's been saying almost from the beginning, this is a completely misplaced use of resources. This is not how. So it's the craziness is still out there. I guess I got some pushback from, a sliver of the libertarian world, but most of those people have almost no following. Right. So I'm not really that worried. I mean, those are people who think we should be wearing masks outdoors. And because Dr. Fauci is the recognized expert, it must be crankish to oppose him. And you're embarrassing libertarians by opposing Dr. Fauci. I think you're embarrassing libertarians by supporting Dr. Fauci. and incidentally, I'm not a libertarian because I think automatically every so-called expert is always wrong and that every bit of conventional wisdom is always wrong. That's not my position. Sometimes they're right. Every once in a while, they are right. But on this, we had a way of checking. I mean, we could see they try this plan here and that plan there, and this works and that doesn't. Or if their outlook, if their strategy happened to be the correct one for coping with this, then people who didn't use that strategy, they shouldn't just be 10% worse. And they should have been obliterated. Not only were they not obliterated, they did just as well or better as places that, ruined everybody's life. So there's no debate about this anymore, it seems to me. You can graph different places by social mobility, like how much were people moving around and not staying home, staying safe. You can graph it by when mask mandates went into effect, and you can graph it by lockdown stringency, and the results are entirely random. And incidentally, sometimes when you talk about mask mandates, people will say, well, you can't really talk about that because people sometimes wear masks even without a mandate. And I agree with that. That's true. But I was in Charleston, South Carolina, for about 5 days. And by pure coincidence, it happened to be during the very time they were dropping their outdoor mask mandate. So I was there at a time when you had to wear it outdoors, and I was also there the very day you didn't have to wear them outdoors. And I'll tell you something, those masks went out the window like that. So don't tell me that that the mandate doesn't have any effect. In some places, it absolutely does. But yeah, I actually didn't get that. You know, I didn't get that much pushback because, first of all, I've muted all the blue-pilled libertarians. I don't care what they think. I mean, half the people in the Libertarian Party were talking about things like, civil asset forfeiture during 2020. And I'm against that. I'm probably more against it than they are. But how tone-deaf can you be? That's what you want to talk about in 2020? That's the big issue? So I'm not even interested in their opinion.
Yeah. I think something that was revealing about the last year is that you can't just oppose the state, right? I mean, if you kill the mandates of the state, but the public still goes along with the status quo and keeps pushing a narrative, it doesn't really matter. So you have to oppose the narrative as well. You can't just oppose what the state is doing. You know, I think there's been a lot of confusion there.
Right. And I mean, obviously the state is driving this. If it hadn't been for state-driven hysteria, it's hard to believe absolutely everybody would have bought into this. So, but at the same time, yeah, I mean, the reason we oppose the state is that we oppose the initiation of aggression.
Right.
And that's what the state does. But other people also initiate aggression, so we're against that too. Or other people spread ideas that are going to lead to the initiation of aggression, so I want to fight back against those ideas, which is what we're supposed to do in a free society.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there were, I can't tell you how many times whenever I've opposed a social push or a new social norm that people have said, I thought you were a libertarian. I thought you didn't care what other people think. And it's like, well, no, I don't want to force my ideas on other people. But if you have enough people brainwashed into thinking a certain thing that isn't true or that's harmful to the rest of society, that hurts people. I mean, so you have to oppose it. And I'm not going to use the state to oppose them, but I'm going to use my voice and my platform and the information I can put out there to oppose them.
Yeah, this is one of the worst misconceptions. Even some libertarians have it. You know, so one bad guy gets banned from Facebook and they say the market has spoken. So the market is one corporation handing down a decision. And since when, you know, companies have complaint departments. That's also part of the free market. Am I not allowed to use the complaint department? Because that's anti-free market. This is so juvenile and stupid. It's not worth wasting our time. It boggles my mind that anyone could think this. So I go to a restaurant and they try to serve me a well-done steak when I ordered medium. And I'm just supposed to say, well, I guess that's the free market. Who am I to complain?
Right.
This is idiotic. And these are the same people who would say to Woolworth, they didn't say to Woolworth, well, you know, you have segregated lunch counters. I guess that's the market speaking. No, right. They protested that. They said, that's wrong. You shouldn't do that. Okay. Well, yeah, that's what we do. We complain. We say things are wrong. We don't automatically say that every corporate decision is the free market speaking. I mean, this really is a dumb, dumb caricature. And notice it comes only from people who are obviously not well-read. It comes from no scholarly people. So if you look at people who might be on the left wing of libertarianism, the ones who have actually read stuff don't go in for this nonsense. Sheldon Richman doesn't. Gary Chartier doesn't. The actual scholars don't do any of that. It's the, you know, frankly, the shit posters on Twitter who go in for it because none of them have read anything.
Yeah. What I do think is the hard concept to grapple with and to figure out where the balance point is with cancel culture, because cancel culture in and of itself isn't actually a bad thing, because that's what we're doing by opposing, you know, vaccine passports. Like, we've made threats, like, we're not going to buy from this company if you guys start using vaccine passports, if it's a privately run enterprise. So I'm wondering, where do you think the balance is? Like, when does cancel culture become this toxic thing that we've become familiar with nowadays? Where's the balance between using it to oppose things we don't like, and then where it just becomes ridiculous and it's actually working against free speech and shutting down people who have important things to say?
Well, I don't ever believe in doxing anybody for any reason. So that's the first thing, that people's privacy shouldn't be violated and their families shouldn't be made to feel insecure. So that kind of thing, I don't even consider. I don't particularly want to try to ruin people's careers because they have the wrong opinion. I mean, I think there are a lot of people out there with terrible opinions, but I want to just, like a normal human being, just hash it out with them. I don't want to say to everybody, well, they work at such and such hot dog stand and you should see if you can get their license revoked or something like that. That thought would never occur to me, nor would it occur to any civilized person, honestly. I mean, part of the reason that it occurs to these folks is that they've worked themselves into such an irrational hysteria that they claim to see Nazis everywhere. I'll tell you something. There basically are no Nazis in America. I mean, the idea that Nazis are the problem in the United States today, with the left in the saddle in every conceivable area of life, absolutely every area of life, absolutely dominant. And if you doubt me, name me three conservative victories of the past 100 years. I don't think you can. Okay?
Right.
I don't think you can. The left is in the saddle in every single area of life. So the idea that Nazis, whoever they, okay, maybe there are 36 of these people. They have zero support. They have zero money. They're all losers. No one favors that cause. That's what you're going to be worried about. And meanwhile, over the past year, none of those people ruined your life. None of those people made you burn through your savings for no reason or subjected you to pseudoscientific nonsense that little by little they're walking back. Now they're saying, well, you know, we don't even know. There are actual epidemiologists saying we don't even know where they got that 6-foot rule. It's like they just made it up. I mean, one actually said that recently. A distinguished professor said it's like they just made that up. Oh, gee, not like other people haven't been saying that the whole time. Or, gee, wearing masks outdoors is pretty stupid. That's the new thing coming from Slate and all the main. It's like, oh, we knew that all along. No, you didn't. Oh, no way you didn't. You were posting pictures of yourself jogging outdoors wearing a mask. Okay, so don't give me that. So in terms of cancel culture, well, I don't, first of all, I think it's a stupid term. I don't like that term. But I have no problem with boycotts and saying, I disapprove not of some secret opinion you hold in the dark depths of your soul. And so therefore I'm not in the business of trying to read minds or hire private investigators to find out the secret opinions of the people who make my ketchup. I'm not interested in any of that, nor should we be, because that would be the end of all commerce and a normal division of labor. But if as a company policy, they say you have to, you know, wear a funny hat when you walk in the building, I could say, well, I'm not going to go to that store until they discontinue that policy. But I'm not going to say, I'm not going to go into your store until you reaffirm me in all my fashionable, trendy beliefs. That's just juvenile. You're reaffirmed in all your fashionable, trendy beliefs 24 hours a day in every channel of every corner of America. And you need your shoe store to tell you Black Lives Matter? You really need your shoe store to tell you that? And then you need the Pancake House to tell you they believe in transgender rights? I mean, are you that fragile that you can't just live like a person? That's the difference.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that it's hilarious that they've been able to throw off the scent of the issue by bringing up things like Nazism, to your point. Like, I mean, it's a non-existent threat, but they can paralyze the country with fear over anti-Semitism and white nationalism, which is so far from being an issue, while they lock us down, destroy millions of jobs, and, you know, cause suicides and depression to go through the roof. It's really amazing.
No, I agree. Can I just jump in? Because there's something I forgot to say. I'm half Armenian. Mm-hmm. And my deceased Armenian grandmother was a single issue voter. Now, a lot of times you hear single issue voter, it's abortion. That's the single issue. For my grandmother, it was the Armenians. And it was, where do you stand on recognizing the Armenian genocide during World War I at the hands of the Ottoman Turks? And my grandmother was a lifelong Democrat, but she loved Bob Dole. I thought, of all Republicans, Grandma, why do you love Bob Dole? And the answer is that Bob Dole was pro-Armenian because apparently it was an Armenian physician who operated on him, who would allow him at least to keep his arm so he wouldn't have to be amputated. And from that moment, he became interested in Armenian issues, and he fought to have the Armenian genocide recognized. Now, that's a very important issue to me, too, because, you know, Armenians should not be second-class citizens. What happened to the Armenians was obviously deliberately planned, and it was terrible. But everywhere I go, again, I don't ask, where does my mustard company stand on the Armenian genocide? Even though that is of profound importance to me, the problem is thinking that every aspect of life should be political, everything. You can't leave politics out of anything. That's a sick way to live. And that's ultimately my point. It's not like I don't have things that I deeply care about. I do. But I also just want to live like a human being and not have to interrogate every single person who serves me in the division of labor.
Right. Yeah. The other thing that's kind of funny about that is, you know, I feel like this is all obviously pushed by the public schools. And you talk a lot about how conservatives have not conserved anything. You were just mentioning it there a little while ago. That has been like the number one conservative issue, is getting kids back into public schools. What's your take on that? I mean, I know it has to do with employment and parents going to work. I know that's part of it, but it is kind of ironic that while the country's being destroyed by a bunch of idiots who were brought up in these schools, the conservatives who want to conserve everything are hell-bent on getting the kids back into those schools.
Yeah. I mean, I'm of two minds on this, because the arguments being used to keep them out of school are so dumb that even I find myself saying these are dumb. And if those are your arguments, then the kids should be back in school. They had already done the key study on this by April of 2020 in Iceland that found that the schools are not a source of spread. Children themselves are basically not a source of spread. There's actually an interesting suggestive, not absolutely definitive, but suggestive study out of Scotland among healthcare workers there, that they found that if you have a child in your home, that healthcare workers with a child in the home were less likely to get sick from COVID, and that effect multiplied with the number of children in the household. So it's like, in some ways, children are a barrier for you. And it's very, very suggestive and interesting. But so then when we saw what the teachers' unions were up to, yeah, it's very, very hard to resist saying the teachers' unions just want the teachers to stay home and collect checks, you know, and it's so hard not to say, no, get back to school, you know. But at the same time, yeah, of course, it's been obviously a boon for homeschooling. And there are a lot of parents, not a majority, there are a lot of parents who will not be sending their kids back. They're out and they're going to stay out. And that, to me, that was very interesting to me, because the public schools are the state religion. Those are the state churches right there. And I thought, they're going to have to decide one way or the other here, because those are the factories that generate the conformity in the public that they need. And they need those kids in there. They need that more than they need the panic over the virus. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, those two things were fighting against each other. And it's interesting that the panic generally won out over the need for the ideological indoctrination. Now, in the meantime, I mean, I don't know what the surveys say. I don't know what the numbers are. But I can say from my own personal experience that, of course, you know, as everybody at this point probably knows at this point, I promote the Ron Paul Homeschool Program because I helped to create some of the courses for it. RonPaulHomeschool.com is the website. And I was curious to see, would there be more signups this year than in previous years? And what I can say from my end, because I promote it as an affiliate, and I, you know, so I get credit when people join through me, and they join through me because I give them bonuses nobody else gives them. But those numbers doubled this year. And I mean, 100% growth in a year, you know, but most firms would be quite pleased with that kind of growth.
I think so. I was homeschooled until high school, and then I went to public school. And I was also raised very religiously. And that was another thing that kind of disturbed me about how this pandemic played out. I thought that the houses of worship would really oppose the crackdowns on allowing people to gather. But I live in Utah, which is a very religious state. And one of the only voices speaking out against the atrocities that the state was imposing on houses of worship was an atheist who was running as a libertarian for my district. He was like the only guy standing up for them. Did that surprise you how much the religious community just kind of took this and didn't really fight it?
You know, I'm sorry to say it didn't surprise me, because as we've seen, most such people, they're caught up in the establishment way of thinking, desperate for approval. They don't want to be viewed as heretics, you know, to use an interesting word. And so they'll do what they're told. I mean, my gosh, if there were ever a group of compliant, pathetic, spineless people, it's the American Catholic bishops. And I mean, indeed, most Catholic bishops around the world. I mean, honestly. So that part didn't surprise me. It's not surprising to me that the resistance came from what we might call the outliers. And the outliers in this case would be traditionalist Catholics, people, for example, who go to the old Latin Mass, you go to those anywhere in the United States and almost no one's wearing a mask and they're at full capacity. Nobody's wearing a mask. Anybody at an Anglican use parish, which is a Catholic form of Catholic worship that was adapted for Anglican congregations, they're very conservative. They're full capacity, no masks. The Society of St. Pius X, which is in a kind of a limbo situation vis-a-vis Rome, they're the ones who actually were behind some of the lawsuits over the capacity restrictions. And they were in lawsuits. These were lawsuits that were litigated by my friend Chris Ferrara. He and I wrote a book together years ago. And Chris fought these cases successfully in New York, New Jersey, California. And these were cases with traditionalist priests and Orthodox rabbis. And the Orthodox, very interesting. I mean, it's just like traditionalist Catholics. The comparison is, or the similarities are striking. I mean, they're both considered like, as Chris says, the Taliban of their respective religions. They're both treated absurdly. They're both treated as outcasts. But they're the ones who actually had the stones to stand up and say, sorry, we're not abiding by this. And so even an atheist libertarian who is contemptuous of religion has to, in this particular case, appreciate the outliers. And by the way, the outliers is a great way to describe us too, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It was the outliers of all kinds who stood up against this. It was the religious outliers, and it was the philosophical outliers like you and me. It was lifestyle outliers who refused to do it. It was the outliers. It was the ones who didn't care about respectability, who didn't care what their neighbors thought or what Dr. Fauci thinks or whatever, who were willing to make their own risk assessment intelligently and live like a human being.
So how, my memory is a little fuzzy on this, but how early did you go hard in the paint against everything that was going on? Was it immediate or was it a couple weeks or was it a couple months? When did you like snap and say, okay, enough, this is crazy?
I don't know the exact date. I have to go back and look. It was fairly early, but I will say that, you know, I'm not perfect. And early on, I was concerned about it. And mm-hmm. I probably said things that I shouldn't have said. You know, I'll admit that. I'm not going to yank down episodes where I said things that were wrong or made predictions that didn't come true. I'm not that kind of guy.
Yeah.
The good, the bad, and the ugly is up there forever for everybody to see. But I will say that my initial concern, it was that we were in the unknown, really. And, you know, I do an awful lot of traveling, and I am in large crowds a lot. I see a lot of concerts, and I go to the theater a lot. And so I was wondering about, should I do these things? Should I postpone or cancel events? And I just was unsure about it. You know, and there were a lot of libertarians even early on, I give them credit, who said, oh, come on, you know, don't go so crazy about this. And I was saying to them, well, you know, I know people are talking about the boy who cried wolf. And like there's always something we got to be scared of. But I reminded them, you know, in that story, there is a wolf eventually.
Right.
You know, a wolf does come. It's not like all predictions of bad events must be wrong because of the boy who cried wolf. You forgot the ending of the story when the wolf shows up. So maybe this is the wolf. I mean, let's wait and see if this is the wolf. So what made me change a bit was I was looking around just trying to find a variety of perspectives, as I figured there had to be some people who were deeply pessimistic about the prospects and some who were deeply optimistic. So I looked around and I started looking at I think it was statnews.com, and I was told that they were pretty good. But my gosh, it was all doom and gloom from them. They couldn't see any way that this could ever turn out to be less than the millions upon millions upon millions upon millions of deaths scenario. And I just wondered, can it really be that there's no way we can look at this as this is going to be a very bad thing, but it's not the end of the world? It's going to be a very bad thing, but we have to balance all health concerns and not just monomaniacally focus on this one thing. And I could find so few people saying that. It just seems so weird to me. Like no one's thinking about the side effects of what happens when you just decide, oh, well, let's just shut society down like the communists did and see what happens. That just seems so sledgehammer. That can't be.
Yeah.
And then the tone of some of the reporting was so utterly unprofessional. The way the reporting was happening in April of 2020 about Japan, it was Japan is going to get killed by this virus because they're not following the rules. And the rules are the ones that Western public health specialists have gleaned from the Chinese communists. And those rules are, you know, be barred to, you know, inside your house and all this and that. And Japan really wasn't doing that. I mean, they made some recommendations and this and that, but you could see Japan public transport. They were all squeezed in the whole time. I mean, you know, it was very mild, and they were being the headlines. And I've repeated them in my news. The headlines, it was almost like a glee they were taking. Like, yeah, Japan's going to get pummeled. Like, and the measures they're taking now are too little, too late. And now Japan has been so successful against it that they barely know what to say. Instead of, well, gee, huh, maybe this thing's a little more complicated than we thought. How did Japan get away with this so easily? You know, like they like to point to East Asian countries that really, really cracked down that did pretty well. But Japan didn't. And they also did pretty well. So this is what Jay Bhattacharya calls policy invariance, that in East Asia, no matter what you did, whether you cracked down a lot or you just did a little, you got a good result. So that should have made people curious. What is it about? Is there something peculiar to East Asia that could account for them? But very, very few of these questions were being asked. And that kind of attitude of, yeah, you wait and see when those hospitals are filled up. And I thought, you know, you shouldn't be talking like that. You should treat this like a tragedy. You should say, if things go the way we fear they will, this could turn out very badly for Japan, and that would be very tragic. That was not the tone we got. And then afterward, it was excuse after excuse after excuse they were trying to come up with to explain it away. It could never be we were wrong. Never. Now, if our side makes a prediction that doesn't come true, oh, we never hear the end of it. Right. You know, you can't listen to us ever again. But they make hysterical predictions with glee, with almost a bizarre excitement and nothing. And it's like when Georgia opened up, it was like they wanted death in Georgia. It was almost like they wanted it so they could say, we told you so. I mean, you remember the headlines in the Washington Post about Georgia angling to become the number one death destination in America, and the Atlantic said that they're running an experiment in human sacrifice. Georgia is completely average in its result. Average. So where are the apologies? No apologies. We just forgot all about that. Okay, I'll be right back. So now you got to somehow keep people's attention. All right, I'll be right back. I have to lie down and have this administered to me.
All right. Hey, guys, thank you for watching this. I want to give a big shout out to Dave Smith. He's the one who helped me set this up. He's obviously friends with me and friends with Tom Woods. And I tried to get it's kind of hard to get a hold of some of these people if you don't know them. So Dave was my connection there. I don't know if he's watching or if he'll see this, but thank you, Dave. And yeah, I was hoping to get him on for episode 100 because it would have been round and, you know, the big climax, but it's all good. As long as I get him on, episode 106 is fine. And yeah, we're working with some complications here. I'm in a truck stop, so the internet's not that great. And then obviously he's got the LASIK surgery that he had today, but liberty is too important a cause. So we're still here and he's back. So the second half of this, I want to talk about a little bit different subject, but I have had a couple controversial people on my show, and I'm, you know, nowhere near as big as you, but I've had Ryan Dawson and Pete Quinones, people kind of that ilk. And I get a lot of pushback for having them on. I've watched a lot of your interviews, and I remember one in specific with Stefan Molyneux, where you told him, I want to have you on because people don't want me to have you on. Yeah. And I think that's great. Do you want to just expand on that a little bit? Why that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't want to let people tell me what I can do. And as Dave says, he can have very friendly conversations with left wingers. And nobody says, why didn't you call them out on blah, blah, blah? And right. And usually it's because the leftists who complain about Dave don't care about blah, blah, blah. They really don't, honestly. Right. They care about three vaguely libertarian things. But honestly, they don't care about the welfare state or that. I mean, they could get, and Austrian economics they think is crankish, you know, so they don't even believe in that. I mean, so none of them, they don't care about the Fed. None of them care about this. Like, these aren't the people who criticize us are the last people you would ever go to if you had a, could you imagine if you had a question about interest rate formation that you'd go to Adam Bates? I mean, you know, like, it was, thought would never, ever cross your mind, right? Or if you want to talk about homesteading theory, you'd go to Andy Craig. I mean, really? Would that ever enter your mind? Never. Now, I'll never mention their names ever again. I shouldn't have mentioned them now. Add up their audiences, and I would say there might be four people who'd be willing to cross the street to hear them speak. Okay, that's about it. Dave and I fill entire banquet halls with people. You know, so, you know, who cares, right? But so, like, for example, I had Ralph Nader on my show, and I thought, well, there are a lot of things I disagree with Ralph Nader on, but while he's on my show, I'm going to focus on areas of agreement because I want to talk to people about liberty, and I want to find common ground and see where we can work together and build on that. So we talked about corporatism and anti-war. We had a very pleasant conversation. Not one person wrote to say, look, he has done a lot of destructive things to the American economy that have harmed a lot of people. Not one person.
Right.
But if I have Molyneux on, it's, well, I can find five out of context sentences that he said, and they are out of context. They are.
Mm-hmm.
None of these people have ever listened to a conversation by Molyneux. Absolute 100% guarantee they have never, never actually listened to him. And I don't listen to that many podcasts. Maybe I don't agree with Molyneux. So I don't know. I don't care. What? So what? Who cares? How could Molyneux possibly be worse than John McCain? Impossible. Right. That is literally an impossibility. Now, for blue-pilled libertarians, they actually respect John McCain because he's a war hero and he was in a prisoner of war camp. Like, they actually think that way. I don't think that way. I think the man was a monster in every conceivable way. He was in no way a maverick. A maverick. Yeah, a maverick means sometimes he sided with the left wing of the establishment. Oh, wow. What a crazy maverick that guy was. If I had John McCain on, there wouldn't be no concern at all if I had a friendly conversation with him. So these people have zero credibility. And Molyneux has done a lot of very important work, and he's very interesting. And particularly on peaceful parenting, he's been outstanding on that. So, yeah, for crying out loud, so what? I mean, just, again, and again, most of these people are children. It's like we're talking to 12-year-olds. And again, then go start your own podcast where you have people who are going to spend all their time talking about price controls and how price controls lead to shortages. If you want to have boring shows about that, or if you want to say the same thing over and over about legalizing sex work, which I believe in, I totally believe in. But if you want to have that on every episode, go ahead and do it. And we'll compete in the free marketplace of ideas and see who wants to listen to your show and who wants to listen to mine.
Yeah. I'm like you, where it's not just that I don't care that they think that, but they actually drive me to want to have those people back on. Like, I've had Ryan Dawson on 3 times now. I'm having him on again next month. And I want to, because I almost like the reaction it gets at this point, because you're right. They're just children. They're just so ridiculous. So,
well,
I mean,
also, it just goes to show I'm not even listening to them. And the thing is that my audience keeps growing. You know, I keep expanding. I'm doing new things. I'm launching a new membership site this year. I mean, Tom Woods Inc. keeps on growing. And my mailing list has doubled over the past year. In less than a year, my mailing list has doubled. I don't think that can be said for a single person who has criticized me. And not to mention, I mean, I did win the Hayek Lifetime Achievement Award, and I don't believe they have a habit of giving those to fascists and Nazis. They've given it to Peter Thiel, to Arthur Laffer, who inspired the Reagan tax cuts, and they gave it to Deirdre McCloskey. So, you know, not really in the Nazi category. So it makes them crazy, honestly. The more success I have, the crazier it makes them. So that's one of the perks of success is evil people get driven crazy. Hooray! Good.
Yeah. So I came off the Rand Paul campaign and I found out about the Libertarian Party really in 2016. And I voted for Gary Johnson. And then I actually officially joined the party last year. And when I came into the party, I didn't realize that this split existed. You know, I knew that every libertarian thought he was the only real libertarian, or, you know, all that bullshit. I already knew that, but I didn't realize that people hated you, hated Ron Paul, hated Gary Johnson, hated, yeah. I mean, it's just like, choose your guy and you hate him. It was just ridiculous. Cause I was thinking, you know, we're libertarians and that's already such like a narrow philosophy compared to the rest of the country. But we find this bullshit to tear us apart.
Yeah. Okay. Can I jump in here on this?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So I'll just say those people are loud, but they have no audience. The anti-Ron Paul libertarians, if they still had phone booths, they could have their convention inside one. It's just that because they're losers with no job, they have time to tweet all day. And it makes it seem like there are more of them than there are. Half of them are sock accounts. I mean, for heaven's sake, when Ron was running for president, these people didn't dare say a word. They didn't dare say a word because they knew they would get steamrolled by all the good libertarians who were out there working their tails off for this man. This man who, you know, in his 70s, is flying all over the country. He can't sleep in hotels. He's a wreck, and he's doing this for us. And he's talking about the things that matter. And they make a big production of how anti-racist they are. Look, this is a guy who couldn't possibly be more against the war on drugs, couldn't possibly be more against the Fed, couldn't possibly be more against the wars. Those three things do more to screw up young black men than everything else put together.
Right.
I've told this story before, but I'm friends with a man. I'm going to conceal his identity, but some people will know him, but they already know me and they know him. But he's a former Marine recruiter, black. And because he's black, they sent him to recruit young black men. And he would recruit them. And then some of them would get cold feet and say, you know, on second thought, I don't think I want to do this. And he said, may God forgive me, but I would say to them, hey, man, you're going to get in trouble. You already agreed to it. You got to do it. When I had no right to say that, of course they can back out. But I deceived them into thinking they couldn't. And who knows what happened to them? Who knows what happened to their brains, their hearts, their souls being churned up in that machine? Like that's got to stop, right? That's got to stop. Making people think that that's your way out is joining the war machine. That's got to stop.
Right.
And Ron was the only one who said, the problem with the wars is not just that Americans are dying. It's that innocent foreigners who don't look like us are dying, okay? Right. The anti-racist people almost never talk about that. Almost never. So none of them would have spoken against Ron because they're cowards. And so they're anti-Ron openly now because he's not in the public eye as much. And also because the whole establishment is anti-Ron, and they're always with the establishment. They're with Fauci, they're anti-Ron, they're with McCain was a great statesman, even though we disagree with him on pot, you know, like whatever trivial BS they have to say about everything. But yeah. It is a small sliver. I mean, honestly, I mean, as you know, like I'm going to have a huge crowd at my 2000th episode event, October 16th in Orlando. That's going to be fantastic. None of these anti-Ron Paul people could do that. And half the time when they do, you see one of their people speak at a conference, the person bought his way into the conference. I could name a name, but generally no one wants to go see David Bowes of the Cato Institute give a speech. I guarantee you, okay? When he's at a conference, that is not because there was a groundswell of support to hear the guy is the world's biggest bore, all right? The Cato Institute dumps some money on the conference and he gets up there and talks. Okay, I mean, that's it. Their side is a paper tiger. Our side is where the ideas, the intelligence, the scholars, and the excitement and the grassroots enthusiasm can all be found. That's our side. Now, last year, for the first time ever, I spoke at Porkfest in New Hampshire. Porkfest has got all kinds of people. You have squares, and you have very, very not squares, let's say. But everybody, it's like the old Ron Paul movement, you know? Even though we're different from each other, we all just enjoy each other. We all just have a great old time. But I thought, well, this might not be Woods country exactly these days, given how divided the movement is. So who knows? I got up to give my talk on that main stage. The entire place stood up before I even said a word and cheered. So, yeah, I know there's a handful of people who don't like me on Twitter. But I'm telling you, they would slit their own grandmother's throats if they could get a response like that.
Yeah. So I think the other thing that's kind of funny is you know, a lot of people who are in the Libertarian Party, they always scold people for not joining because, you know, they're like, what do you do? Why are you saying anything if you're not part of this? Well, then once you join,
then they're upset you joined.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean,
hey, stay out.
Yeah, right. I mean, I didn't join until last year because I just thought the party was such a joke. And so then I finally joined and I'm talking to people on the left and the right, you know, finding crossover and trying to bring them more toward liberty, and everyone was freaking out at me that I was an entryist, you know, trying to bring people in and, you know, overrun the party with non-libertarians. And I'm like, what, you guys are a social club, you know, you want your 100 people who all think exactly the same and to never change anything.
Yeah, that's right. Because everybody, it's kind of like what it was like being a student in the Ivy League. There are so many student publications because everybody wants to be the editor of something. And it's exactly like the Libertarian Party. Everybody wants to be in charge of their little fiefdom. So it doesn't really matter. You know, they try to paper this over with, well, we've got this deep, profound strategy for winning elections. Yeah, okay. Yeah, looks like it's working out terrific for you. It is what you're saying. It is that. It's an old boys network. and they don't like people elbowing their way in, even though our libertarian credentials are so ridiculously much better than theirs. I mean, in the Libertarian Party of Nevada, you have people who openly mock the non-aggression principle, openly mock it. The non-aggression principle is the moral foundation of libertarianism. And their arguments against it are totally stupid.
Well, I mean, what's the definition of aggression? First, you have to know what property you...
So what? So what? Yeah, there are a few definitions you need to know first. So what? That would be true of any axiom in geometry. Like, what is... The objections are juvenile and can be dispensed with in 5 minutes. So those people are going to lecture... Then there's another one over there. There's another one over there in the LP of Nevada, who says that the atomic bombings of Japan were justified. So
oh, nice.
incinerating women and children, that was justified because our regime was at war with their regimes. In other words, he thinks like a normie. He thinks like a blue pill person. He thinks, well, since our group of sociopaths was opposed to their group, it's okay for these totally unrelated people to be incinerated. That's not how a libertarian thinks. That's why you read Rothbard's essay, War, Peace, and the State. A libertarian does not think that way. And so it's not a surprise. That person is against the non-aggression principle, thinks we should be wearing masks. Who knows? When we're sitting up in our treehouse or whatever it is. Whatever the establishment view is, he kind of wants to take a 3% more libertarian view of it. And he also said, this is my favorite, he disputed that Murray Rothbard was an Austrian economist. So I said, well, unfortunately, against you in that assessment would be such irrelevant nobodies as Henry Hazlitt, who said the opposite, that nobody economist Ludwig von Mises, and that other nobody economist who won the Nobel Prize, F.A. Hayek, all of whom clearly said that Rothbard was a key and important member of the Austrian School of Economics. But we do have some guy from the LP of Nevada. We do have to weigh that in the balance. I mean, these are the people we're intimidated by. Why? That guy's an idiot. Jason Weinman is his name. He's an idiot. If you think that, and you don't know what Mises said or Hayek said or Hazlitt said, you're not entitled to an opinion. So you're just embarrassing yourself in front of people who have read books. I know you don't hang out with many of those people, but they're around social media and they see you're an idiot.
Yeah. Yeah. So I agree with you on the extreme dichotomy between people like that and people like yourself. Then there seems to be more of a middle ground. You know, there are people who do not buy into the establishment narrative, but they're also kind of weirded out by, you know, the Mises Caucus people. They think they're a little too far. I don't think that those two factions should be at odds. You know, like, I mean, I would put someone like Justin Amash more in that category. He's not someone who buys into propaganda, but he's also someone who tries to present the message in a way that doesn't scare people. So we might disagree with that on some level. But I don't look at him as the enemy. Do you think there's a difference between...
No, there definitely is. And Amash has scolded the kinds of dumb guy social media right. libertarians I've talked about, rightly scolded them. And that's hilarious because they all support him. And so when he scolded them, I got a big laugh at that. But I mean, he's not really my style, but I would not consider him my enemy. I agree with you. And I don't think he considers the Mises Caucus people his enemy. No. And also I disagree that the Mises Caucus are explaining the message in a way that, quote, scares people. And so, you know, Amash is the more moderate voice. The difference is, if you listen to Dave Smith, like on Joe Rogan, I think he's just speaking a lot of common sense that people just never hear. There are a lot of people who are enthusiastic about the war in Afghanistan. I mean, really? No. Like, who is thinking about that today? Who's enthusiastically in favor of that? There are a lot of crazy policies out there that we can oppose without making anybody scared. We just state a lot of obvious moral truths that may challenge some people, but it's not like we're making bizarre demands of them. But whereas I think that Amash, in trying to make the message palatable to people, goes a little too far. Like when it looked like he might run for president last time, he went on MSNBC and gave an interview that just had nothing to do with libertarianism at all. It was, we need an honest alternative to the two parties who have betrayed us and done this and that. We need a leader who's going to be honest and speak the truth to the... What does that mean? I mean, anyone could say that. Ralph Nader could say that. Anyone could say that. Mm-hmm. So how is that advancing? You're on MSNBC. You have a chance to reach a ton of people, and all you're going to give is that milquetoast answer? Now, I don't want, Woods hates Amash. I mean, come on. You're not 12 years old. Just because I disagree, that doesn't mean this word hate is so ridiculously overused. I am critical, yes, because you had this golden opportunity and you gave this flat answer with no philosophy in it. Nah, we can't do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have kind of realized that the radical messaging is almost more pragmatic sometimes, because people, you catch people's attention and they realize you're right. Like when Ron Paul said we should legalize heroin in South Carolina, I think that Fox News tried to make him look dumb, but the audience didn't think he looked dumb, you know, and I think everyone who heard it was like, yeah, what he said kind of made sense. So I think we are sometimes afraid to just say what we think, and we actually push people away by being afraid of what we...
Yeah, I agree. Because in particular, the so-called pragmatist messaging doesn't attract anybody, because why wouldn't I just vote for a Democrat or a Republican? Like, if your message all day long is going to be, you know, we favored gay marriage even before the Democrats, the best that will get you is people saying, hey, good for you. You guys were really out in front on that. But the Democrats really are leading the charge right now, and they're the ones winning elections. So I'm going to vote for them. So what's the point of that? Honestly, I mean, other than to say we've been right for a long time, that I'm okay with. We've been right for a long time about gold or whatever else, if you want to make that point. But if you think you're going to win people over by stating commonplaces that they can also get in the other parties, you're just selling the other parties. Why would you do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what do you see as the future of the Libertarian Party? What do you think its purpose should be? Do you think it should be to try to win elections, or to try to be a think tank or a messaging tool?
You can win elections if the country has a substantial minority of libertarians, and it does not.
Right.
So the purpose of the party, it seems to me, is to get people to think in radically different ways and then see what we can do with that. Because let's face it, most people are not libertarian. I mean, that's obvious from 2020. They were told to do preposterously destructive things, and they just went ahead and did it for months, month after month after month, without a peep. So yeah, we have a lot of work to do. But you might say, well, then what's the point of having a political party? And the answer is that most people get their political theory from elections. They don't get it from reading John Rawls or Robert Nozick. They get it from reading newspaper articles during election time. They get it from watching YouTube videos by politicians. And if we're not part of that, then we're not going to be heard. It's not like, well, if we don't have a party, then people can just read our political theory books. Well, but they won't, okay? They won't. So all you're doing by saying, I'm too pure for politics, what you're really saying is, okay, then the libertarian position basically will not be heard except by nerds who have time on their hands to look up videos.
Right.
You know, so that's why I think there is some value in it.
Do you think that some people think that we need to have too much of a monolithic message? You know, like, I agree with the Mises Caucus a lot when they're upset about how the social media will put out messaging at a really horrible time and it's not connected to what's going on, or the newsletters or whatever. But I do think a lot of people feel like everybody needs to have the exact same message when different messaging reaches different people, you know.
Yeah.
So maybe we need to alter the way the centralized Libertarian Party is messaging giant issues at certain times. But there seems to be a push for everybody to be exactly the same, and I don't think that's right. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, it is supposed to be a federal system, the Libertarian Party, like the United States itself. It is supposed to be that way. And strictly speaking, the state parties can do as they like. And by the way, first of all, yeah, I would like to see much, much, much better social media work from the Libertarian Party. It's just boring and embarrassing. It's utterly boring. If you just want a sinecure and just have some hack position in the Libertarian Party, then yeah, then keep this going. But if you actually want to make a difference, then the Libertarian Party's Twitter account needs to be like the Wendy's Twitter account, which is funny and shocking and keeps you on your toes. And it should be like that. Why should it be, we also oppose bigotry? Look, every reasonable person opposes bigotry. Come on. Every single every shoe company, every company that sells cutlery, they're also against bigotry. All right, we already know that. Okay, I think every reasonable person gives strangers the benefit of the doubt and assumes that you have no hostility towards strangers. I think we all owe each other that benefit of the doubt. But what a boring series of messages they've had, especially during 2020. It's utterly inexcusable. But I do think that there are ways of tailoring the message that don't betray the message. And, right. And Ron Paul is really a model of this. He used to go to evangelical conferences or events during the political campaigns. And he would speak to them without betraying any principle at all, but with arguments that they could understand. He would make biblical references. He would use historical references. He would give specific examples of state overreach into people's families. That reaches them. Now, he could also have gone in there and talked about a million other things that wouldn't have resonated with them at all. Why don't you meet people where they are? Now, isn't that interesting that that's what the pragmatists also say? They also say, people are not radical libertarians. Let's meet them where they are. Okay, I can agree with that to an extent.
Mm-hmm.
Let's find them where they are. Let's find where our common ground is and pull them farther in the good directions that they have. Not just kind of pat them on the head and say, you're already doing a good job just as you are. You know, like you Republicans favor a 20% tax cut and we favor a 27% one. Like, why are we doing this? Right?
Right.
I think there are people who can reach folks on the left much more effectively than I can. Although I'm telling you, in my inbox, I have a ton of people. I'm not even trying. And they say, I was on the left and I started listening to you and it really challenged me. And now I'm a full-blown libertarian. But because I come from a Republican, you know, background, I know the arguments that work with those people. I know the things that I used to believe, the things that I fell for, the bad arguments that I just accepted reflexively. I know how to spot those weaknesses, those weak points, and say, you've been deceived into thinking X when the correct position is Y. So let me work on that, and other people can work on other folks, and then we all meet together with all the people we brought in, and we're all happy.
Yeah, the last question I want to ask you, because we're coming up on an hour here, is do you think that the word pragmatic has basically come to mean moderate when pragmatism is actually a good strategy, because pragmatism is figuring out what you should be focused on and what you should be stressing, where it's come to mean moderate instead. Like, people think it means like, oh, let's not say that. Let's water this down a little bit so people can buy it. Where pragmatism really would be not watering down your message, just saying, oh, this is a great place to talk about this. This is a great place to bring this issue in.
I mean, because I think you should be pragmatic in the sense that if you're running a libertarian presidential campaign, you shouldn't be trying to make points about 150 issues.
Right.
You should pick three and really hammer those home. Now, if the press asks you about other issues, you're going to be different from other politicians and you'll answer those questions. But you're going to focus on three major things that get people's attention or that nobody else is talking about. You don't take something that they're talking about and then you become 3% different. There is nothing pragmatic about that. That is a guaranteed loser. That's not going to get you votes, and it's not going to get any enthusiasm, and it's not going to change any lives. So pragmatic just means thinking about what's likely to work that does not betray our principles, what resonates with people best from our message. Because once you get them in, you know, sometimes people say, well, how do I answer people when they ask me about the roads? And my answer is, don't talk about the roads. The roads?
Right.
Why would you lead with that?
Right.
What you say to them is, all right, well, how about this? How about, for the sake of argument, I'll concede the roads to you, okay? How about that? The tax dollars can go to roads. Let's talk about these other things. And then you talk about those other things. If you get them on board on those other things and they really start to see the world differently, they'll come back to the roads and say, I'm pretty sure we'd probably figure out how to lay down some tar, for heaven's sake. You know, they'll figure that out on their own.
Yeah, well, I want to thank you for coming on, Tom. I really appreciate it. I have a link to your Twitter, your website, and your YouTube channel so people can go follow you there. But if there's anything else you want to say or any other links or places people can reach you, I'll just let you say that now and then we'll close out.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I like my latest free ebook because it shows all these different charts of, you know, related to COVID that just smash the establishment narrative completely. So I call the ebook COVID Charts CNN Forgot. So I would recommend people get that. It doesn't cost anything. It's at chartstheyforgot.com.
All right. Well, thank you, Tom. I hope to see you at Porkfest. I'm planning on going there. You're going there this year, correct?
Yes, I am. I'll look forward to seeing you there.
All right. Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Reed.
All right, folks. That is it for today. Tomorrow, our old friend Brian McClanahan of The Brian McClanahan Show, who is a faculty member at LibertyClassroom.com. and knows an awful lot and has written a zillion books, is back on the show. And it's always great fun and educational when we talk to Brian McClanahan. So look forward to that. See you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.